House Committee on Business and Labor. Oh, are you ready? Oh, now I'm going to open the House Committee on Business and Labor, and I'm going to start off with an informational hearing, and we're going to be brief and concise and move right along and call in Lou Savage and Lon Holston. Come on up, guys.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lou Savage. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor with the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Most of you are familiar with the Management Labor Advisory Committee, which is composed of five members, each from business and labor, appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. And MLAC is often in front of this committee. It's charged with studying issues impacting the workers' comp system, reporting its findings, and making recommendations. During the last session, there were a couple of issues that were discussed during the session that MLAC decided to take up as interim study issues. One was the issue of volunteers and coverage of volunteers in the workers' comp system. That subcommittee is still hard at work, and we hope to report to you within the next few months. The second subcommittee reviewed the use of interpreters in the workers' comp system, whether there were any problems with workers getting access. And we are happy that we have been able to complete the work of that subcommittee within the last few months. And with me today is Lon Holston, who is a labor member of MLAC and is here to report our findings to you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lon Holston. I'm here representing the Management Labor Advisory Committee on Workers' Compensation, commonly referred to as MLAC, or uncommonly, depending upon your point of view. During the last legislative session, an issue was raised about the availability of interpreter services in the workers' compensation system. MLAC agreed that it was fundamental that a worker who does not use English as a first language or uses or needs sign language for interpretation have access to interpretive services. For this reason, MLAC made a commitment to study this issue as part of our interim work. MLAC established a specific subcommittee to review interpreter services, and I served as the subcommittee chair. Our subcommittee held four public meetings to review the status of the current system and analyze information gathered from other public agencies and other states. We took public testimony at these meetings and also accepted comments by email. We focused our attention on the entire workers' compensation system from start to finish, including claims processing, medical visits, and all stages of the appeals process. The Workers' Compensation Division provided staff support to the subcommittee. The division helped MLAC gather information about what kinds of services already exist, identify areas where interpreter services are lacking, and help identify options to fill those gaps. Our review confirmed that interpreters are widely used and are necessary in the workers' compensation system. This was emphasized through testimony from professional interpreters, the Ombudsman for Injured Workers, members of the insurance community, state agencies, and other interviews with regulatory agency staff. From the first report of injury or occupational disease through the appeals process, interpreter services are used during every phase of the workers' compensation claim. There is no general requirement for interpreter services to be provided and paid for under the current workers' compensation law. Interpreter services are required to be paid for by the insurer at medical arbiter and independent medical exams. However, the insurers and third-party administrators of self-insured employers that were contacted said that as a matter of practice and policy, they pay for interpreter services as needed as part of their claim costs. Many of the non-English-speaking workers use interpretive services provided both by the Workers' Compensation Division and the Ombudsman for Injured Workers during the claims process, appeals process, and for the use of the state return-to-work programs. Additionally, workers often rely on family members and friends or in-house interpreters at the medical offices when available to communicate with their health care provider. Now, it should be noted here that in our study, when we found out how often medical providers had in-house interpreters and how often injured workers used family members or relatives. We wanted to hold that entire system intact. One of the reasons was is that you have interpreters who are practicing along with the physician and they have good communication between the two. On the other hand, when you have workers out there who may be embarrassed by having third-party people in the room, especially when they're providing medical information to the doctor, sometimes they're much more comfortable by having a family member or relative in the room. As part of our review, we learned about two state certification programs for interpreters. One program operated by the Judicial Department provides a certification process for interpreters that they participate in the legal system. The Workers' Compensation Board, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court use interpreters from this list. The Department of Human Services has a voluntary registry for interpreters who provide health care interpreting services for the use by health care providers. Subject to funding, DHS plans to implement a certification program for health care providers, or health care interpreters, excuse me. The most apparent need for interpreter services in the workers' compensation system emerged out of discussions surrounding medical treatment and exams. Since workers have access to interpreter services during the claim process through the division, the ombudsman, during the appeal process, and sometimes through the insurer's staff, medical services presented the biggest opportunity for a gap in communication to occur. To ensure that workers have access to interpreters as part of receiving medical care necessary to address their work-related injury, MLAC has asked the Workers' Compensation Division to propose administrative rule changes that require insurers and self-insured employers to pay for the services of a professional interpreter as required by workers to get medical services, also to establish a fee schedule for interpretive services, limit application of the rule to interpreter services associated with the delivery of medical benefits, limit the fee payment rules to professional interpreters, which does not include family members or employees of the health care provider, and to clarify that payments for interpreter services are only due and payable once the claim is accepted. The division has included this recommendation in their current rulemaking process. And as a note here, they will be meeting as of tomorrow afternoon, and I intend to be there to help with that rulemaking process. Because of the rulemaking process is currently underway, however, we cannot say for certain how the final rules will look. However, I am, and MLAC is confident, that the issue will have much public involvement and have thorough discussion, and that the rules, the final rules, that is, will reflect that input. As part of our subcommittee process, we welcomed and encouraged public testimony. Our public notices were distributed to a wide variety of stakeholders, and we did receive good input from a number of people. We anticipate that more input will be obtained during the rulemaking process. In addition, any medical service providers already, many medical service providers already have trained bilingual medical staff. And there is also many workers who prefer to have family members in the room to interpret rather than a stranger. We did not hear about any problems in these instances when interpreters were used during the medical treatment and exams. MLAC did hear a proposal from a stakeholder asking that we recommend a certification program specifically for interpreters in the workers' compensation system and a requirement that only certified interpreters be used. After careful consideration, MLAC did not feel a separate certification program was needed. MLAC and the interpreter subcommittee felt that implementing an interpreter certification would only add cost to the workers' compensation system. And I do want to thank Ron Vrooman publicly for him bringing this issue forward. He brought it to our attention and to the legislature's attention that there was a need there and that we should study it. And MLAC agreed to take it up and to run through that process, and he was with us all the way through that process. So I thank you for the opportunity to be here and to talk with you about our work, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Before we do that, I see Mr. Vrooman's in the room. I met with him several weeks ago and discussed this, and I told him I would reach out to various stakeholders, department, And I did, and this is a list. I don't know if it's complete. Independent medical examiners, OMA, SAFE, other private sector insurers, representatives from labor, management, members of MLAC, administrative law judge, staff in this building that have been here a long time, my colleagues. I have had virtually no contact from anyone else except for Mr. Vrooman, and I do appreciate bringing things to our attention, but I got to tell you, I think this can be solved at MLAC. I don't think we need any more bills than that. And if we do, if there's workers out there who aren't getting proper interpretive skills and services and are injured financially or mistreated medically, I'm confident we're going to hear about it. So that's where I'm at on this, just to get it on the record. Anybody want to ask these gentlemen any questions? Okay. Well, thanks, guys.
Mr. Chair, I just had a real quick question. So if there is interpreted services that are hired today, that occurs today?
Hired for the injured workers? Yeah.
Correct. And I understand that if they're in the doctor's office, they're not compensated for that. The doctor basically supplies that service.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, you're absolutely correct.
Okay. If they are hired from outside services, does the cost of that go into the claim cost of that particular claim?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Go ahead. Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, yes, it does. And in fact, those are paid now by the insurers. In fact, what we're really doing with this rulemaking process is lining up the rule with what most of the responsible insurers do now.
What's practically happening.
That's right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
Right.
My able staff here. Anybody else signed? We got anybody else on this? All right, then I'm just going to move right along. I need to ask the most important person in the room.
What do you need?
Teresa? That's exactly right. Just we're ready to go right down the line.
Mr. Chair, yes, before we start the public hearings, did you want me to explain what we're doing, I guess?
Yes, that would be wonderful.
There's been some confusion in the midst of the House, how the House is doing committee bill introductions in Senate. There are no votes that are going to be taken on any of the committee bills today. What will happen is on opening day, February 1st, each committee has an allotted time to do bill introductions, so that's what we're going to do at 11 o'clock. That's when we will be meeting to do bill introduction and such.
Okay, so we're just having public hearing on these drafts.
Yes.
We're not creating.
Yes.
We're not. There's no vote necessary.
We cannot take a vote today.
Okay. Very good. That means, and we're ready to go right now.
Representative Bailey's here for the first.
I would like to open up public hearing on House Bill 3604. And while Teresa's explaining what it does, Representative Bailey, if you'd like to come up and join us.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 3604 modifies provisions within House Bill 2956 from the 2009 regular session, which was related to required language in an RFP or an invitation to bid that's issued by contracting agencies for interstate bridge construction projects. The current statute requires RFPs and the bids to include a preference for products, materials, and components to be fabricated from either Oregon and Washington or Oregon, Idaho, respectively. House Bill 3604 removes the specific state reference and changes the language so that the products must be must be fabricated in close proximity to the site in which they will be used. The measure also requires contracting agencies to give preference for such items and goods and procurement of goods for which the life cycle analysis shows that the methods and materials used in the manufacturing, usage, and disposal will help Oregon meet the mandated state greenhouse gas reduction targets. There is an emergency clause effective upon passage.
Okay. Representative. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jules Bailey. I have the honor of representing House District 42 in Inner East Side, Portland. It's a pleasure to be before you today. As you have no doubt seen in other committees as well, a number of the bills that have come forward are bills that are still, shall we say, works in progress. This is definitely one of those bills. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the concept of what was behind the bill and where the bill is going. The bill in front of you, as you see it, will undergo significant revisions before it's presented for your consideration. House Bill 3604 is a partnership with our brothers and sisters in labor, looking at how do we come up with a process that will allow for a set of criteria and considerations to be developed that will take into account the location of manufacture and where contracting organizations are located to the extent that they help the state meet its greenhouse gas goals. So clearly, if you have local sourcing of a material, that has a benefit to not only to the economy, but it also has other benefits as well in making sure that we're keeping jobs here in Oregon as well as meeting our greenhouse gas targets. Similarly, you'll see language in there around a life cycle analysis. That language on life cycle is still under definition, still being defined, but what it's intended to convey is the idea that, for example, if you were to source a product from hypothetically China, for example, and that product was then shipped on a barge which has a relatively efficient usage of fuel, does not contribute significantly to greenhouse gas emissions, but that product was manufactured in a way that it's using, say, dirty coal to manufacture that product, that you could take into account the entire life cycle of that product so that we get credit for the work that we've already done here in Oregon in advancing our agenda around climate change and around linking that to job creation. So House Bill 3604 is really about creating jobs through clean energy and making sure that we're getting credit for the good work that we've already done. The revision that this bill is going to undergo will make it more of a study bill and really take a step back and say, there's a kernel of a concept here that perhaps has some merit, but we want to take a step back, take a look at how we might develop some of the methods and the criteria around how this process is going to be developed, and then submit it back for your consideration in 2011 to see if you agree with the methodology and if you agree with the direction that it's going. So that's the form of the bill that you'll see back in front of you as opposed to what you see in front of you right now. So I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, and take any questions.
Well, before I do that, I thank you for bringing this forward, and I know your intentions are right and good, and I support the concept, and I'm always looking for ways to build bridges between, you know, people like me and people who want to create jobs and those that are very concerned about the environment, which I think is everybody. But Representative, one thing I don't want to do is paint us in a corner. You know where I'm coming from here. What I don't want to do is add restrictions that makes it more difficult to build something in Oregon. But conceptually, I'm with you. I'm grateful that it's a work in progress. That's what I wanted to hear today, and I appreciate that. And I will, with that, open up. Anybody have questions to the good representative? All righty then. Good job.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the record, I would agree with the sentiments that you just
expressed.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I have some nice people here. I'm just going to call you up at the same time. Is it Diane? Mm-hmm. Diane Lancaster, Doug Tyndall, and Bob Shipwreck. Whoever wants to go first.
How about I'll do it? Be quick about it. Thank you for having us here today, members of the committee. Representative Schaffler, for the record, I'm Diane Lancaster. I'm the Chief Procurement Officer for the Department of Administrative Services. We had some significant concerns around the bill as it has been drafted. The department is, of course, totally supportive of environmentally appropriate and productive procurement. We will be delighted to work with any study group or any discussion to help tailor the bill to be successful in the 2011 session. And with that, I think I'm ready to ask if there are any questions of me.
Go ahead, guys.
They pick me next. Bob Shipwreck, Oregon Building Trades Council. Representative Bailey, I think did an expert job at describing that this is a work in progress. Every time we think we've got it right with this bill, something else comes up that we didn't contemplate in order to not create a situation that the chair described of causing unintended consequences. So I'm looking forward to a work group. However, I just want to share one story about the frustrations that we have, and I think everyone on this committee shares this frustration. I was reading my engineering news record. It's a construction industry weekly magazine that talks about global construction projects and what's going on in the country. And I was going to ask Doug to double check this, but The steel that was delivered to the Bay Bridge in San Francisco was fabricated in China. When the iron workers began welding it, they discovered that it couldn't meet the specifications because the steel was so bad. The entire project has to be rebid now, and obviously new steel, the whole thing. I've been involved in energy projects where we get a transformer from Turkey that blows up not once but twice, holding up a major powerhouse. That's what we're trying to avoid, and put these industries built with American businesses and American workers. And that's what we're after. I hope everyone understands that, and I think everyone agreed that's important. And hopefully we're going to get this right in this bill, but that's, I wanted to just share it.
Go ahead.
Chair Schaffler, members of the committee, Doug Tindall, Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Transportation. We too share the goals of the bill and recognize the importance of local products and sustainable products. As we work through, and we look forward to hope that we're involved in working through the bill, in the particular aspect that we need to consider from the ODOT standpoint is that we have a federal law. Our federal funds come with a federal restriction on geographic preference, and we need to be careful how we build this law so that we don't cross that line, because the federal government can't participate in some wordings of geographic preference. The way this bill is worded now, that would be a problem for us in terms of getting federal participation. So we look forward to working towards the goals that Representative Bailey stated, and I think that the chair stated as well. Thank you.
Yeah, like Bob, I, a couple years ago, I toured the Bonneville Dam with one of the committees I was on. They're retrofitting those turbines, mm-hmm. and the millwright out there was forming the job. I said, you know, they're putting these giant props in. I go, where'd you get that? And he goes, well, we got it from Brazil. And I said, really? And he goes, yeah, the first ones, then built in the 30s by American craftsmen and engineers, without the benefit of computer and all this stuff, ran perfectly for 70 some years. They yarded that one out. Put in, and nothing against Brazil, but they put the, you know, we got the low bid here. Put that thing in, turned it on, and it had a wobble in it.
Yep.
And they had to pull it out and redo the whole thing. And I tell you, you know, you get what you pay for. But any questions of these good people? All righty then. Thank you very much. Anyone else want to testify on House Bill 3604 today? We're going to be hearing it again. You're going to get your chance if you want to later, but you can now. Okay, thank you, Representative. With that, I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 3604 and open a public hearing on Legislative Concept 210. Teresa?
Yes, Mr. Chair, committee members. Legislative Concept 210 authorizes a state extension of unemployment insurance benefits by reauthorizing the remaining balance of the $30 million that was allocated from the UI Trust Fund for funding the state benefit extension that was authorized in House Bill 3483 from the 2009 session, and the dollar amount is $19 million. The concept also gives the Employment Department rulemaking authority to allow more Oregonians to qualify for the current federal and state extended benefits program that is funded from the Federal American Recovery and Investment Act. There are the emergency clauses on the concept that's effective upon passage.
Thank you. We have the department. Ms. Warner.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the director for the Employment Department. With me is Tom Byerly. He's the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division for the Employment Department. We're going to run through a few background slides here with you and then talk about the concept. The first one here is the trust fund schedule of where we've been over the last 30-some years. As you will remember, in the session we talked about being in Tax Schedule 6 for 2010, and that's the notices that we just sent out to employers this fall, and we've moved to Tax Schedule 6. The trust fund will be in Tax Schedule 8, or projected to be in Tax Schedule 8 for 2011 through 2014. The LC before you is not going to affect these tax rate schedules, at least as we currently see them. So the next slide is basically a bunch of numbers in front of you. This is the, on the left-hand side, this is the trust fund forecast process. On August 31st of every year, we look at the balance in the trust fund, and then we, based on the statutes, determine which tax schedule we're going to be in. And you will note on the far left-hand column that August 31st balance in 2008 was over $2 billion. And as you watch the years go along here, you'll see that the balance is dropping as we pay out more benefits from the trust fund. So we take that into account, and then the tax schedules reflect, go up and down from there, and it's self-balancing. Oregon is one of a few states in the country right now that have a solvent trust fund that we're not borrowing from the federal government, and it is largely because of the work that was done in the 70s setting up this mechanism in statute, and it has served the state well over the course of many years. The one thing you'll note on the far right-hand side are the projected low balance points. We also watched this. The first quarter of every biennium is usually our lowest intake of tax revenues from businesses, because the wage threshold is around $30,000, and so by October, November, December, many workers have reached the $30,000 threshold, and so we don't collect as many taxes October, November, December for the first quarter in January. And so you can see in 2011 and 2012, the low point for the fund, while it's higher in August when we do the projection for the tax schedule, we're going to get down to around the $200 million level in the trust fund. So we watch that carefully because depending on how the payments go out of the fund, I had sent you some information saying we might have to do short-term borrowing in that quarter. That's not being insolvent. That's just a cash flow issue based on when tax receipts come in. The next slide is the current UI benefit programs that we're currently paying out under. The regular benefits is 26 weeks, and that comes out of our own trust fund. The emergency unemployment compensation and the extended benefits, the middle two programs, are fully federally funded at this point. And these are the programs that they keep re-upping basically at the federal level and extending the eligibility dates for people so that people have benefits for longer periods of time. They did that this fall, and that extended not the number of weeks but the time period that people can qualify for these benefits. They moved it out to February 28th from December 31st on these programs, and so that basically saves our trust fund money because they're paying for some of these benefits. So the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program is the bottom one. This is the one you approved during the last session to spend $30 million on this program, starting in October, running through January 2nd. That program has ended. We've spent $11 million of the $30 million that was appropriated, authorized for this program. And we spent less because, frankly, the feds extended their other programs and people moved on to emergency unemployment compensation or extended benefits, and so we saved some money. The there were about 2,000 Oregonians who didn't qualify for either one of those programs that have been on Oregon Emergency Benefits during that time period. So the Oregon Emergency Benefits, the profile of the people that are on this program right now in the last few months, they're about equal male, female, 53% female, 47% male. Most have high school educations or less. About that's almost 78% of them are high school educated or less. And they basically were working in food service, clerical, or retail type of jobs. So those are the folks that have been on the program. With that, I'm going to let Tom talk to you a minute here about claims, and then we'll talk about the LC.
Thank you, Lori. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Byerly. I'm the administrator of the Unemployment Insurance Division for the Employment Department. This is a slide that I've brought to your committee before. It's an actual and forecasted number of brand new or reopened unemployment insurance claims. You see the dark line there, how we had quite a spike a year ago in unemployment claim filings. You can see that they're on the downward trend. That isn't necessarily, I want to point out, because the economy is improving. It's because individuals have been out of work so long they're no longer qualifying for unemployment benefits. And herein lies the reason that you saw the trust fund balances going down as we're continuing to pay out a substantial amount of unemployment insurance. And you can see a forecasting going forward, it's going to continue to slowly decline. These are the individual weeks claimed. In other words, this is when an individual calls in or files over the internet.
I'm on the last one.
I'm sorry, I'll go back.
On the last one?
Yeah.
Okay, then in January, March 10, it goes back up. Is that going to be as a result of this extension?
This
Why
would
does
be,
it go back up in January?
Mr. Chair, this would be regular new claim filings. And this is typically an upward spike every January as seasonal work ends, retail from Christmas ends. We normally experience a spike in January, February of each year.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Again, these are the weekly claims that people file for their unemployment benefit payment. And you can see that the incline or the cliff was quite steep beginning the summer of 2008. Went straight up, and so again, this is more evidence of a substantial draw on the trust fund. In fact, just in regular unemployment benefits alone, last week we paid $31 million. With all federal programs and all, we paid $66 million in 1 week in unemployment insurance in the state of Oregon. So the number of unemployed workers is still quite high. You can see it's going to continue to climb for a little while, and then it's going to start going down. And again, I want to stress, this is not necessarily related to the economy, although we are seeing some job listings come in. People are running out of eligibility. Specific to Legislative Concept 210, this would be an expansion of the Oregon Emergency Benefit Program that was passed by the 2009 session in House Bill 3483. And as Lori indicated, there was $30 million allocated or accounted for in the trust fund for this extension, and $19 million of it wasn't paid out because we were fortunate and the feds extended the emergency unemployment compensation extension, which allowed more people to draw federally funded benefits and save this money in the trust fund. This expansion, as drafted, would provide up to 6 weeks of benefits for individuals that don't qualify for any other claims, any other federal benefits or new claims. It would be the last claim that we could file for them, and it would, again, stay at the $19 million that was left over from the original 30. A second part of this is what I'm calling an extended benefits reach back. We did this in House Bill 2203 last session to allow federal funding, maximize federal funding that was being made available as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act was extended to February 28th. We can now reach some people that didn't file for extended benefits before that would otherwise go on this Oregon extension, so we can use federal funding to pay them. We think about 2,000 people are out there that we could possibly reach, and if all were to come in on that part, it'd be about $9.5 million to unemployed Oregonians, and I want to stress this would be all federal money, not out of the trust fund. So with that, that's in a nutshell the concept that we're working with the committee on. Any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Great. Well, it's going to be the first order of business of this committee. We don't need any other bills, just need this one. All right. Anybody? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. If 210, okay, you gave us projections and forecasts as things are. Does it take into account expanding the OEB?
Yes.
It does. Okay, so that's accounted for. Thank you.
Chair Schaffler and Representative Thatcher, the forecast that you have, that second slide with all the numbers on it, that was as of December, and so it included spending the $30 million in those balances. So it's already, that's been accounted for.
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just going back to the schedule. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I'll pay attention, Mr. Vice Chair. Go ahead. And
no, I'll yield to the good representative.
Oh,
go ahead.
Good.
We're
go
such ahead. Great gentlemen, ladies and gentlemen up here. Go ahead, Representative.
Thank you. I'm curious. I just heard an economist that used to work for U.S. Bank that gave a talk on the economy.
That's okay.
And he may have a little different slant. Of course, if you have 10 economists, you have 15 opinions. We all know that.
Yeah.
But his indication was that this economy is going to last for quite some time. And we, being one of the five top states for unemployment, I don't think we've done much in the way of creation of jobs here as of late. We've just been losing or maintaining our low level. I think we're fourth or fifth in the nation now, which is better than second, which we were for quite some time. But still, maybe it's just because the other people are performing worse than we are. I'm not sure. What happens to this fund if in a year or two nothing's changed?
Chair Schaffner and Representative Esteval, remember that folks, we showed you on the number of types of benefits that are out there. They get 26 weeks of regular benefits, and then when those are exhausted, we don't pay more out of this trust fund for benefits for people unless you authorize that in an extension program like the Oregon Emergency Benefits. So, and they run through their federal extensions that they have available to them. So I think Tom's slide that's showing you those drop-offs and what we're paying, those claims we're paying out of the trust fund, means that our claim volume is going to go down. That doesn't mean that people are employed, however. It just means they don't have benefits to sustain them. So, you know, our trust fund tracks with the forecast that we work with the Office of Economic Analysis with Tom Podowski's forecast, and yes, we do take that into consideration in terms of this trust fund projections.
Follow up, please.
I understand that, Lori, but what I'm saying is when people have exhausted everything, what then?
I can answer
because
that
they don't have a job. We don't have job availability. And now, once they've exhausted all these benefits, what then?
We're out of money then, and you're out of luck. And you got to have a radical look at what we're going to do to create jobs in this state. That's what.
Chair Schaffler, if I might, Representative Esteval, we have been, remember I told you there were about 2,000 people here that have been on Oregon Emergency Benefits, and so about 3 weeks ago, when we knew this program was ending January 2nd, we began calling those folks and taking a look at their registration, their work registration, and talking to them about what's your plan, because essentially you're going to be out of benefit. We did a number of job referrals to job openings because we do have some more listings. Many of the people told us that they had moved in with relatives or with family or with friends. Many of them were on other public assistance, and or we referred them over to other public assistance like food stamps and those kinds of programs. So, you know, there is another safety net there, but many folks are drawing on multiple safety net provisions in order to get by. And some of them are taking part-time jobs and other kinds of jobs that won't meet all of their needs but cover some of them. And some of them just have no other resources. So I think as a state, we face that question.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Warner, thank you for coming and sharing this with us today. I just want to make it clear or make sure I understand the schedule went from 3 to 6 this year. And when I look at that, just without looking at anybody's experience rating or history in their particular business, that's an 0.8% of payroll dollars, if I'm reading this correct. So on $1 million payroll, if a company has $1 million payroll, they're going to be paying $8,000 more in unemployment taxes this year. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So a high labor intensive business that's running 40%, I'm just going to use an example, it has a $2 million payroll, is going to be paying without their experience rating, and in a bad year that experience rating went up. In fact, I know one business that's going to be paying on $2 million, about $26,000 more, and I just want the committee to hear this, $26,000 more in 2009 in unemployment insurance than they paid in 2008. So we hear debates about taxes and those kinds of things right now. $26,000, and this particular business that I'm referring to is huge. It's half their profitability for last year is going to be going into this fund. If you look at it, the schedule is going to go up to Schedule 8. So I want to make a point, so because we're a business and labor here committee, I guess I don't have a question other than I want to make sure that everybody understands the fact that these claims, as they go up, take the fund down, but to replace that fund, businesses in this state are impacted in a very negative way and are struggling right now. And there are going to be some businesses that won't be able to stay in business as a result of a 1% tax on their payroll. And I just want to make that point. So this is another one of those things that businesses are facing that are struggling today in Oregon, and they will do their best to try to recreate this fund that they've already paid into. Thank you for being here and presenting the real facts.
And that being said, Representative, you know, this system actually works relative to other systems around this country, and your points are well taken. Then you add on to that continual increasing in regulations and restrictions and the inability for Oregonians to use their own land to make money, the not allowing businesses to develop water. I'm going to beat this to death. We have more trees in this state than we could grow it better than anywhere. We're sitting on a gold mine. It's going to burn up. God forbid you dig up a little gravel in this state. It's unbelievable. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to pick up on your comment or answer, perhaps, to Representative Esquivel, what happens. I have a very rural district that's significantly challenged in terms of its economic opportunity. We have an official unemployment rate that's the average of the two counties is over 10.5%. If you take a look at the involuntary part-time workers and the marginally attached workforce, you can double that number. We're looking at in excess of one out of every five people in my district suffering some kind of unemployment. And I can tell you it is disastrous. I can tell you that the social safety net is stretched to a max. We've just heard the employment department talk about the social safety net. You can talk to virtually any one of the social providers. You can talk to the clinics right on down the line. I had General Caldwell in my office yesterday describing some of the social problems that veterans face because of unemployment, which is off the Richter scale in terms of where our veterans are. And that as far as I'm concerned, is intolerable. General Caldwell told me something, and we need to take note of this, because our veterans are no different than everybody else. What he said was, you give a person a job and 80% of those social problems disappear right now. And we have a lot of opportunity in this state. Earlier this morning in our subcommittee, Representative Esquivel had a bill to try and clear up in the permitting process delays that in the permitting process that are denying us business opportunities in this state. We have allowed challenges to permitting process, which rather than taking the view that a permitting process is an opportunity for business in the state to show us how good they are, how good their projects are, how good our workforce is, that's been upended, and it becomes a process by which we deny economic opportunity in the state. And Mr. Chairman, this has got to change. This has got to change, and it's got to change quickly.
My vote, Representative Hovey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the comments. It is an extremely painful period for both business and workers across this state and probably across the nation. And, you know, we can all point the fingers about what happened to make this economy go into this tailspin. But I think it's important to focus on where we're going, for sure. And I appreciate all those comments. I have, I guess, more of a question about the statistics and the data. The chart that you show and the big drop off in claims, you know, as you've alluded to, isn't really because people are going back to work; they're just running out of benefits. I guess my question is: do we have statistics? that, or do you have statistics that track the numbers of those people that have exhausted their claims, and are you able to track whether or not and when they go back to work, so that you could really get a feel for what the true unemployment is, as opposed to, you know, the unemployment based on the amount of claims, but actually the amount of people out there that are out of work or not working?
Chair Schaffler, member, Representative Holvey, those are like three or four questions strung together. We know when people exhaust. We know when they go back to work because we can track their, we have their Social Security number, we can track that. You know, the question about, you know, where they go back to work and when they go back to work, it may be in another state. It may be, you know, clear across the, our state. So a lot depends on personal choices and such that they make. But the unemployment rate, remember, is not based on the number of claims we have here. The unemployment rate is calculated via a survey done across the country that's sampling of people via phone call. You know, have you been searching for work this week? Are you employed? Are you not employed? And so that's a statistical sampling methodology that's dictated by the Bureau of Labor Statistics so that it's comparable across the country. The number of UI claims is a whole different group of numbers, because not all the people that are unemployed when they answer the survey would qualify for unemployment insurance. Only about 60%, somewhere between 60 and 70% of those that are unemployed qualify for an unemployment insurance claim for a whole variety of reasons. So that sometimes gets confused, but those are two different sets of data. So, and I think Representative Witt was speaking to how many people are discouraged workers or have taken part-time jobs. That all influences the unemployment rate, which we are going to publish and put out next week, Wednesday, for December. So those are different. This is how many claims
we pay. I understand that. I was just kind of curious if we have some sort of grasp of what those numbers are of those people that are not collecting unemployment insurance benefits, and that have actually, because they're exhausted and are out of work in the state.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holvey, I'm pretty sure we do. I would check with our research department to see what kind of numbers they collect. We collect data on a lot of different things because we don't want to lose where workers go. And I would add also, another thing a lot of people are doing is they're going back to school because they're trying to get retrained in something that they have to be more long-term and sustainable. So those people are, you know, they're doing their best to find other work.
And just for the record, I do point my fingers at a lot of problems in the state, but I'm not pointing at you. These rate increases are painful, I won't deny that. But imagine where our economy would be if we didn't have this system. And it is among the best in the country, and you're doing a good job.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Cameron, I know an unsolicited comment, but in other states, they're facing losing part of their FUTA credit. They're going to have to be paying interest at some point. Their tax rates will go up to their top scale, and we'll have a surcharge on top of that to bring their trust funds back. So
right. Yeah.
I don't deny this is painful. And I talk to businesses all the time, and it's a tough time to raise taxes. I just thank goodness for the legislature in 1975 that gave us the system we have.
We're only talking about unemployment insurance rates today.
unemployment tax.
I insist
tax.
On, yeah, the unemployment insurance tax, Representative. Representative Thatcher.
I just got a letter from a constituent today, and talking, maybe I misunderstood, I wish I'd brought it with me, but she was talking about the WorkShare program. Wondering if you could address that a little bit. Are there some changes about how employers are going to be charged on that? And so it just kind of renders it kind of pointless. was kind of gathering that from my email.
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, there's been some notices sent out to workshare participating employers that if their charges exceed what they would normally pay on their benefit ratio and the number of claims and their experience, then the amount of money above that they would directly reimburse the trust fund for. This is a change that came out of the 1991 legislative session. And so their charges are going up higher than they normally would had they not gone into workshare. As far as the actual monetary gain or not, that would be a case-by-case basis. I would really like to work with you on that if I could and help explain that to the employer.
I would appreciate that because it sounded like they would just be ending up laying off some workers, and then it would end up costing the system even more. So that didn't make sense to me. So I would really like to work with you on that.
Chair Schaffer, Representative Thatcher, could I reach out to staff or to your staff?
Please.
Okay. Representative Kinnaman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciated the comments earlier about the need to get beyond some of these regulation impediments, and wanted to add my amen to the revival service that was going on.
Hallelujah.
I also wanted to comment about Representative Holvey. Just this last week, I had two of my constituents talking to me about the unemployment rate. The one lady is a former realtor, self-employed, obviously, and now is closing down her one-woman print shop. And she says, you know, the interesting thing about my situation is, she says, I've exhausted all my resources. I don't have unemployment to back me up, and I don't show up in the statistics.
Right.
And I guess that was echoed by the lady who had a knick-knack shop in Oregon City, a small gift shop with all kinds of things, and she's closed it last week. And she said, you know, not only is the economy taking a toll on my business, but she says, I don't have resources to go, and I may be moving in with my parents at 47, which was sort of an embarrassing thing, and nowhere to go, and she doesn't show up on those statistics. So, you know, when we talk about some of this unemployment rate, we need to realize there are a host of folks who are outside the system that not only miss this great resource, mm-hmm. and a resource that we pay for and everything, but also aren't even accounted for. And so when we're talking about unemployment rates at 20% in some of the rural areas, I suspect actually it's substantially higher, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of these entrepreneurs and small business people. There's no way to count where they are.
Representative Cameron, and then I think I'll move along unless anybody's burning up to ask a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this may be a discussion for future. I heard Representative Thatcher, Tom, refer to the workshare program. Is there, and I know you have restrictions, but getting outside the box today, is there any creative ways that we could, and in follow-up to Representative Witt, you give people a job and a lot of problems go away. And sitting at home collecting an unemployment check is not a job. It doesn't do anything for my self-esteem. Is there any creative way that we could help get people, as they're collecting unemployment, not just in school, but working somewhat for that employment? And I don't know if it's Workshare or what programs we have today, but is there any thing we could peel back some of the layers to do? And I've always heard that it's federally restricted on drug testing and things like that. What options do we have that we could explore as a legislative body?
Excuse me. Chair Schaffer, Vice Chair Cameron. There are lots of different things we could explore in job creation. There are some restrictions when it comes to using unemployment as a subsidy or a part of that puzzle. We've been kicking around ideas with us, ourselves. The feds are looking at things. I would like to say the sky's the limit. Let's sit down and talk about some things. But we do bump into some restrictions on the federal side about having to be unemployed before you can get an unemployment check. So we may want to have to look outside of that. But I think the sky's the limit. We just need to have the conversation.
Representative Chair Schaffler and Representative Cameron, the issue on the federal level is if you're drawing unemployment insurance, you're talking about whether they could work while they're drawing unemployment insurance, and those two things have typically not gone together and been harder to get around. So what we have been able to do is allow people to draw their unemployment insurance and go to school for retraining. And you approved a program for low-wage workers last session that's a pilot that started in November around that so that we can retool people. But the question, I think, at the federal level is whether or not they're going to have job, some kind of program that would help job creation, help businesses put people back to work and take them on, and maybe, you know, subsidize wages or do something along those lines so that we get people back to work, because basically that's what all these people need.
And I want to be real careful. I mean, yeah. I'm not supporting any diversions out of this fund.
Yeah.
It would have to be within a certain context, and I just want to be whatever we do. Tom, I don't think the sky's the limit. I'm just going to say, throw that out there. I'm interested in working within this concept to help on people that are unemployed, but I'm not supporting any diversions away from this fund. It would take a lot to get me to do that. Just to clarify where I'm at on all this.
I was just suggesting that conversation should.
Yeah, we always have a conversation. I'm all for that. But I want to be careful with what we do with money.
Shopping.
And I want to be real careful where this money goes and who gets it and who benefits from it. Because I want that unemployment worker benefiting from it first. So we'll have the conversation. I'm open for a conversation. But it's, you know, when we start talking about this money, I'm going to be very conservative with my vote with this money.
Chair Schaffler, I think the point in showing you the low points of the trust fund is being drawn down to the point of almost zero. And so before it rebuilds, that's why you're going up to Tax Schedule 8. And it's kind of the Schaffler general approach where you set a max and you stay there for 4 or 5 years rather than ratcheting up some more. So it sets a limit on that business tax. But there isn't a lot of money there to do other things with right now.
And I know we need to move on, and I appreciate Tom's... I appreciate the sky's the limit and the fact that how creative can we be within the parameters and how many of those parameters can this body touch. But I'll give you an example. I know of a restaurant in Eugene that closed down, and those people could have been hired by a restaurant that was coming in after them, but the restaurant chose not to hire those people, and they did something else. But, and I'm just using this as an example, had those people, instead of being going on unemployment benefits because of the shutdown, been picked up by that new employer, I'm just using that as an example, maybe that employer could have had some sort of, maybe it's a credit on his 2.3% for those people that he picked up for those 13 weeks. It's just a little bit. But I'm just saying, you know, how... You see what I'm saying here? I mean, how creative could we be to say, hey, look, here's somebody who's going to be laid off, and this would help an employer and the employee stay working instead of being sitting at home saying, I'm depressed because I just lost my job.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. And hopefully next time we see you, things will be better.
Thank you.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on legislative concept 210 today? All right, if not, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 210 and open up a public hearing on Legislative Concept 148.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Legislative Concept 148 makes a number of technical changes to Senate Bill 519 from the 2009 session, which focused on employer and employee rights related to participating in or employer-sponsored meetings and communications that are regarding religious or political matters. Major provisions within this concept include clarifying the newly created statute's applicability, modifying the definitions of political matters and religious matters, and changing the maximum amount a prevailing employee can win in court. There's an emergency clause on this concept effective upon passage.
Thank you. I have my friends Duke Shepard or Tom Chamberlain. I'm not going to pick. You can both come up, or you can decide which one's going to come on up. All right. Happy New Year, Tom. Mm-hmm. Duke, you're welcome to come on up, too, if you want to.
Chairman Schaffler, members of the committee, my name's Tom Chamberlain. I'm president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. In 2009, the Oregon legislature passed Senate Bill 519. And I want to address two issues before I get into the bill, because there's been some discussions that the response this legislation is part of how we're responding to a federal lawsuit. That is not true. We have been working on this legislation since sine die of 2009. These changes do not impact in any way or driven by that lawsuit. In fact, some of the changes were things we discussed near the end of last session, and we've refined and added other ideas to them. There is no poison pill in this legislation. This legislation was reviewed by Legislative Council and the Attorney General's Office of the State of Oregon. So there isn't a poison pill in the legislation. But during the session, we did hear some criticisms of the bill. And what we're doing today is trying to make this bill more workable, clearer, and better for the state of Oregon. I'm going to take each section and walk through it and explain why those changes are occurring. Section 1, we delete 4. Our contention from the outset has been that this bill is about more than union organizing. During the legislative process, we were unsure how to be specific, how specific to be in order to ensure that the full policy objectives were met. As the bill was reviewed, further, we believe that defining labor organizations is unnecessary, especially in light of constituent groups that are named in the are not defined that are named in the Act. It also unfairly exposes the law to political criticism that distracts from the policy. Political matters. The definition is amended to include the specific citation of the ORS related to ballot measures. We felt that existing language was enough, but upon further review, we determined that some clarification should occur so the ballot measures are part of the legislation. This is a minor change and doesn't change the intent. Religious matters, that definition was changed. This addresses an issue that was raised by Senator Farioli during the Rules Committee hearing on the bill. He asked, what is a bona fide religious organization? And no one had an answer for him. Well, today we do have an answer. And that definition is Title VII of the federal definition in Title VII. Section 2, page 3. Treble damages is removed and replaced with double back pay as damages plus reasonable attorney fees. Our interest is in keeping the policy with some recourse for workers, but not turning the law into a platform for lucrative lawsuits. Section 4B, elimination of collective bargaining agreements. Again, since this is now law and not a bill, better outside review has occurred. While the original intent was just to make doubly sure that collective bargaining rights were protected, we now know that language could be seen as carve-outs for unions and some employers to strike a deal to allow the very behavior we're trying to stop. We doubt this would happen, but we want to make sure it doesn't. Section 4D, replace religious organization accommodation with better language. Some organizations that has a partly religious mission raised this issue during the session. We respect the role of religious employers and simply want to be clear of that in the bill. This is not a huge change. It is a slight improvement. And Section 4, this is a new section, F. Simply an additional safe harbor for employers to make clear that the narrow focus of this bill. This may be redundant, but it addresses issues raised by legislators who wanted additional assurances that employers can do what is legally required of them. And this section is driven by that legislative concern. Be happy to answer any questions you may have of me.
Well, you know, thanks, Tom, for doing this. We had this in 07, and passed out in 09. It's been rather a painful process, but I'm grateful for the fix-up here. Yeah, for me, it's pretty simple. As a condition of employment, I'm not interested in my boss, my employer, forcing me to listen to the Chamber of Commerce or the AFL-CIO. Dick Cheney or Al Gore. Reverend Sharpton or Reverend Falwell. Because I don't, that shouldn't be a condition of my employment. Very simple for me. pretty simple, and I think you're clarifying that here, in my opinion. Any questions of Mr. Chamberlain today?
Representative, would this bill, would this change allow me not to have to listen to you anymore?
No, you're stuck here, pal.
You volunteered for this, pal.
You don't have to listen to me. You've been listening to me? Anyway, enough of that. Tom, appreciate it. Thank you very much. Got two more nice people here, Greg Hamilton and David Russell. Welcome, gentlemen.
Mr. Chair and committee members, it's a pleasure to be with you. My name is Greg Hamilton, president of the Northwest Religious Liberty Association. Northwest Religious Liberty Association represents the constitutional workplace discrimination concerns of Seventh-day Adventists and all people and institutions of faith in Alaska, Idaho, Montana, Oregon, and Washington. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has two hospitals in Oregon, Portland Adventist Hospital and Tillamook Adventist Hospital. David here, my colleague, is from Portland Adventist Hospital. And it has a second largest healthcare system in the world. That is why amendment proposal to Senate Bill 519 is so important to us and private and religious institutions it represents. We support LC 148 because in Section 2, 4C, and 4F it corrects the inadequacies of the language of Senate Bill 519, particularly when it comes to the religious autonomy of private and religious institutions to require their employees to adhere to their established mission standards and its policies and the requirement that employees do the same. So we're mindful of that. We are grateful for these changes. We're grateful for the sensitivity that has been put forward by the gentleman that was just here, Mr. Chamberlain, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And we thank him for that. That's all I have.
Go ahead, sir.
Chair Schaffler and committee members, thank you for the opportunity that we have to come and speak with you. I am not submitting written testimony today, but just wanted to share some brief comments. Adventist Medical Center was established in 1893 as a part of the Seventh-day Adventist Church outreach in the Portland area. And over the years, we've grown to an employer that has over 2,000 employees. We serve more than 1,100 inpatients each year annually and over 200,000 outpatients. So significant impact in fulfilling our mission of service to our community. We have had very serious concerns regarding the impact of SB 519 on our ability to continue fulfilling our mission, fulfilling our religious, faith-based mission. As a faith-based organization, our history, our mission, and our policies are inextricably linked to the principles and tenets of Christianity. Please let me share our mission with you. The mission of Adventist Medical Center and those who serve here is to demonstrate the human expression of the healing ministry of Jesus Christ. You can see that if we are prohibited from engaging our employees in religious or faith-based conversations, our ability to communicate our mission to our employees and to continue to fulfill our Christian-based mission of service to our community would be severely impacted, if not really destroyed. While we do not require our employees to embrace our practices or the practices of any particular faith, we do require each employee to clearly understand our mission and values and our policies to fulfill the elements of their individual jobs in full and complete harmony with our Christian-based mission and values. So I strongly urge you to include this language in LC 148 that will clarify and clearly document the rights of faith-based organizations to completely and fully engage their employees in conversations regarding their mission, our mission, and values, and our policies, including those principles and tenets that are clearly rooted in religious, Christian-based principles. Thank you.
Thank
Happy
you.
To answer any questions.
Cedric Hayden, is that doctor? Dentist? Yeah, he's a good guy. Any questions, these gentlemen? Representative.
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I applaud you gentlemen for being before the committee, and thanks for your testimony. I
I want to also applaud the efforts of Portland Adventist. I've had all three of my daughters born in your facility, and you have just an incredible staff. Several friends of mine happen to work there. But I also want to say thank you to Mr. Chamberlain, AFL-CIO, on bringing this forward. It would be very easily to walk away with the win once the legislation passed and to not be open to fixes or to suggest that they're needed. And I think this is where best policy comes from. When we get together after the fact and say, there's some consequences or things that need to be tweaked, let's get with organizations that have significant concern and get a better product for the people. And so thanks for working together, everybody involved, and thanks, Mr. Chair, for hearing the bill.
My pleasure, and I certainly support anyone in America worshiping the way they choose, and I hope you're all praying for me. I need all the help I can get. Any other questions to these good gentlemen? And we took our daughter to the emergency room while they're off 205. She had some swelling we noticed one night, and we were treated very wonderfully, so keep up the good work. Anything else? These good people. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on LC-148 today? All right, if that, I'm going to close public hearing on LC-148, and I'm going to open a public hearing for some good patient people for Legislative Concept 181.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Legislative Concept 181 gives the Department of Consumer and Business Services the ability to adjust the risk-to-capital ratio at the request of a mortgage insurer, and the concept outlines the process to do such. There's an emergency clause in the measure effect upon passage. And members, I will be handing out to you written testimony from DCBS, which provides some background information on this subject that the bill's concept's focused on.
Okay. We have Greg Peden and John Taggart.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Greg Peden with Gallatin Public Affairs here today representing the Mortgage Insurance Companies of America. With me is John Taggart, Vice President and Associate General Counsel of Genworth Financial and the Chairman of the Working Group for MICA on the issue of risk-to-capital ratio. What we've got before you, as Teresa articulated, is a bill that would take the current risk-to-capital ratio of 25-1 for a mortgage insurance company out of the Oregon State statute and give the Department of Consumer and Business Services the administrative authority in certain circumstances or under certain criteria to waive or adjust that standard or that risk-to-capital ratio. And I'm going to let John go into some of the details here on what the mortgage industry is about, why we think this is needed, and why we're asking for your consideration.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, thank you for your time. Mortgage guarantee insurance is a commercial line of insurance that protects lenders and investors against losses arising from borrower defaults on residential mortgage loans. And we are the private sector equivalent of FHA. The Veterans Administration Guarantee Fund is also a form of mortgage insurance, as are the state mortgage insurance funds in a handful of states. California has one, New York has one. But we're the private sector provider of protection against losses on high loan-to-value ratio loans. The sweet spot of our customer base are first-time home buyers and low and moderate income borrowers. We insure those loans, and our insurance is a substitute for credit, for equity. In recent years, since 2007, as you might imagine, we have been paying a lot of claims. Our claims exceed by quite a degree the premiums that we're collecting, and so our risk to capital ratios have been rising. It's expected that if trends continue, one or more of the six companies that write this product in the United States will breach 25-1, and under the laws of or regulations of 16 states, including Oregon, they would have to stop writing business. And so what we're asking in Oregon and the other 15 states where we're working this issue is the creation of regulatory discretion to allow the Commissioner of Insurance or the Director of the Division of Insurance to look at a company's financials and the nature of the book of business that they've written and exercise their judgment to allow that company to temporarily operate above 25-1 as this cycle plays itself out and as things return to normal. We're not changing 25 to 1. We are creating discretion to waive it temporarily. If a state that has the rule doesn't create that discretion in some form, then as companies reach the 25 to 1 risk to capital ratio, they'll have to stop writing business in that state, and that will in turn result in fewer home loans being made. The loans that we insure are mostly sold to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae. They're the investors in the loans, and their charters require that loans that don't have 20% down have this insurance on them. And so it would have an adverse effect on the housing market in time. Nothing more to it than that. Questions?
You answered my question, what would happen if we don't do this. Want to give me a one sentence for a simple layman like me of what will happen if we don't do this?
If Mr.
Don't
Chairman,
pass this bill.
If Oregon doesn't pass this bill and the companies breach 25 to 1, then they will stop writing business in Oregon.
Right.
They'll continue to write business elsewhere, but they will stop writing business in Oregon. And that means, as a practical matter, that Oregon loans could not be sold to Fannie Mae if they're high LTV loans. If they're above 80% loan-to-value ratio, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac could not buy those loans. And right now, Freddie and Fannie are the only market for high LTV loans, other than Ginnie Mae, the outlet for FHA-insured loans. Now, FHA is going gangbusters, but that's the taxpayers behind that risk. And this is private capital behind the risk.
Thank you. Any questions, these gentlemen? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate you coming forward with this bill. I know you talked to me last session very late about this particular issue and didn't really have time to, you know, get my head around this thing and couldn't really do anything with it. But I do have a couple of questions, and I'm glad that you clarified that this is a temporary waiver of the 25-to-1 for individual insurers. So, I'm a little concerned about the things that the director considers as far as in making this determination whether to waive it, and I think with a little bit of work that you know, and I'll have to look at it maybe they're just fine, but it seems like you'd have to examine the marketplace too, and maybe you can explain to me why you wouldn't. But if there's one insurer that needs to have this waived, and the other five that are operating in the marketplace seem to be doing just fine, you know, I'm just wondering about the equity for waiving it for one, as opposed to the other, because this is about the solvency of that company, so they can continue to write. I understand that, but if the other five don't have a problem with that, I'm just kind of wondering whether that should be extended to that sixth company.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, If it were just one company that were threatened, then your point would be perfectly valid, and I would agree with you. I think that five companies operating in Oregon rather than six is okay. The problem is that I can't give you a guarantee that it will be just one company or two companies. In the case of Genworth, mm-hmm. we do our modeling and we project the future, and we're pretty good at it, but we're not perfect. We don't think we'll ever need it, and yet we support the bill because an industry with only one or two or three players in it is no industry. It's something else.
Yeah,
it's not a successful model. And so when we looked at the 25-to-1 limitation and its historical roots, we decided that it was arbitrary. It made some sense. To have a risk-to-capital ratio limit, to have capital requirements. But as far as what the right risk-to-capital ratio is, nobody knows for sure. So 25-to-1 was developed back in the early 60s. And interestingly enough, it was developed first in Oregon. And it caught on. and it got put in the Model Act that the NAIC published, and then the 16 states adopted it. The 34 states don't have it, but it's an arbitrary number, and so even if we didn't face the current economic situation, we think it would still be good public policy for the regulator to have some discretion rather than be subject to an arbitrary standard. And back to the question as you originally phrased it, it may be only one company. It may be more than one. And so let's be ready in case it is more than one. I think that's the point.
Yeah, and follow up, Mr. Chair, if I may.
I don't disagree with you at all on that. I just think that the department should be able to consider the marketplace.
Yeah.
And in whether or not to grant this waiver or not, and I don't see that discretion for the department in the bill.
Representative Holvey and members of the committee, the industry's position is that the department should look at anything it wants to, and we're perfectly willing to add things to the list. This list came out of a statute in North Carolina that related to extraordinary dividends.
Mm-hmm.
And we were looking around when we were working this issue in North Carolina, what standard should we apply? Our favorite standard was no standard at all. You can look at anything you want, and you just have discretion to look at whatever you want. But the department wanted guidance, and the division here saw the Arizona model, which is complete discretion, and the North Carolina model, and they like North Carolina better than Arizona, so that's what we went with when we drafted. But there's nothing magic about those 12 or 13 items on this list. If there's others that should be on the list,
yeah.
If there's some that don't need to be on the list, we're open to that.
Thank you. Do you want to respond to that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Holvey, to be specific on this point, it's a very fair question. Section 4 of the bill on page 2 lists out a number of criteria, but the first paragraph of Section 4 says the director may consider the following criteria, so it has permissive language there, and lists out those things that they may consider. And then, of course, Section 7 on page 3 says the director shall adopt rules to carry out the provisions of this section. I would argue that does give them broad discretion to look at criteria such as you're suggesting, far beyond what's mentioned in the bill. And I think, as John has indicated, if that's not satisfactory, as I've articulated to the committee, I think we would be open to broadening out the language to allow them to look at other things.
And the department's in the room. I don't think we really need to bring them up. This is a preliminary hearing. This is going to be vetted by a whole bunch of smart people, and we will get to the bottom of it all. And Representative Holvey.
Now, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment that, yeah, I'm just not as confident as the may versus the shall argument, but I'm completely comfortable having that discussion later and talking to you some more about that offline.
Right. Any other questions of these gentlemen? Alrighty then. Thanks a lot, guys.
Thank you.
Anyone else want to testify on legislative concept 181 today? See nobody. I'm going to close the public hearing. LC 188181. Teresa, do you have anything for us?
No.
Anything for the good of the order? All right, then. We're adjourned. Thank you.
Oh, second one.